With Waiuli, you grow it as a perennial.
Okay.
So you grow it, and then if you have a fall planting, you could get your first harvest in about 18 months. If it's a spring planting, you have to wait 2 years. Because the first year, it's really establishing its root system. You don't get a really big top, but the next year, you get a nice big top.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Well, hello and welcome to the Crop Science Podcast. My name is Brian Arnell. I'm an extension specialist at Oklahoma State University with specialization in precision nutrient management. I get to deal with all the technology and all the nutrients in crop production. Today, our guest is Dr. Katrina Cornish. She's an endowed chair and Ohio Eminent Research Scholar at the Ohio State University working within bioemergent materials. Dr. Cornish is a global expert on alternate rubber and latex production, processing, and products with greater than 30 years of rubber biosynthesis, physiology, germplasm improvement, production systems innovation, and alternative feedstocks in the government, commercial, and university sectors. Her inventions and leadership provide the foundation of the current worldwide efforts to develop materials at the Ohio State University. A fellow of the National Academy of Inventors, an American Association for Advancement of Science, and founder and CEO of EnergyN Incorporated and several other startup companies. She leads a program on alternate rubber production, bio-based fillers, and exploration of opportunity feedstocks from agriculture, food processing waste for value-added products and biofuels. Well, Katrina, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really intrigued. I've dug a little bit into your research, and I want to say it's far beyond what I've ever dealt with. So if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about your background, some of your early starts in academia and what you're doing today.
Well, thank you, Brian, for inviting me to give this podcast. I originally come from England, and I did both my undergraduate and graduate degrees at the University of Birmingham. And in background, I'm a stress physiologist, though that seems a long way back. So I moved out to the US, part of Maggie Thatcher's brain drain, actually, and did postdocs at Michigan State, Cornell, and then in Arizona. And that's when I first started working on rubber-producing crops. And it turned out that coincided with when Goodyear had lobbied the USDA to set up a project on domestic rubber production. And I got hired to head up that project. And I spent the next 15 and a half years in the Western Regional Research Center in Albany, California. Now, the original premise was find the enzymes and genes that make natural rubber and stick them in corn or in yeast and put them in the back of the freezer in case there was a catastrophic crop failure of the tropical rubber tree. And we're still waiting for the complete catastrophic failure to happen, but they're grown as clones, and so they're extremely prone to disease. And in the last 6 months of 2019, it only took 6 months for 1 million acres across 7 countries to become diseased with 2 leaf blights, Neophusococcus and Pestalotiopsis. And 2020 saw a 10% drop in the global rubber production supply. Now, the only reason you didn't really hear a huge amount about that because it coincided with COVID. And COVID closed down all the tire factories. And so that 10% didn't have nearly the bite it would otherwise have done. But 10% is about what we import into the United States. And we have no domestic rubber production in the U.S. at all. This is a huge catastrophe waiting to happen because, as I say, they're clones. 6 months and 1 million acres in 7 countries, and that's not even the worst Tervea disease.
Why is it that the rubber, why are we using clones? What is it about the production system and the rubber production system that it's clones that are used and not anything else?
Well, this is because when the Brazilian rubber tree or the power rubber tree was moved from Brazil out to Sri Lanka originally, only a very few plants made the crossing, as it were, went through Kew Gardens and out to Singapore and then Sri Lanka. So the original genetic basis for rubber tree rubber production is very narrow. And then they selected from among the plants, among the trees, for the ones that had the highest yield. And then they bud grafted those onto seedling rootstocks. And so just historically, to get the highest yield, these were all cloned. But it does mean that their genetic basis is extremely narrow. You could go for miles and miles and miles, and they're genetically identical. And it's just been grandfathered in like that, because then they have very reproducible yields, very reproducible system, very reproducible trees for tapping. But the biological risk to that has been largely ignored. And the reason it was moved out there primarily was because in Brazil, which is where it comes from, there's an endemic fatal disease called South American leaf blight, or SALB. And it's very interesting that until October of last year, if you tried to fly from an endemic SALB region into Southeast Asia, there were no direct flights. You couldn't do it. You had to go somewhere else first and then fly into that region. And it's to keep SALB out of Southeast Asia, because it's extremely contagious. Now, and it can't make the ocean crossing because the spores only live about 5 days, but it can certainly make the airplane crossing. Now, in October of last year, I think probably because of the Brazil-China trade talks, they opened up direct flights. I guess it was too inconvenient to have to fly somewhere else and get off the plane. But it does now mean that there is this route to introduce SALB into Southeast Asia that did not exist before. So I think the risk of introducing SALB has gone up quite a lot because of that change.
So take a moment or two and, you know, help us understand what is your research, you know, the focus of the work and what you've been working on to help, you know, provide an opportunity here.
Yes, I can do that. So one of the big reasons we don't have domestic rubber production is because it can't compete on a small scale with commodity rubber from Southeast Asia and West Africa. This is because top dollar for rubber tappers is only $10 a day, and that's more than most of them get. Now, we can't do that sort of thing in the States. Now, if you're producing a few hundred acres and using a pilot plant, there's no way you can produce domestic rubber for a dollar a kilo. You know, it's going to be $10 or $20 a kilo. So so in times of emergency or supply cutoffs, you know, when the supply has been cut off, like World War II, the oil embargo of the 70s and 80s, when petroleum became very, very expensive, and the prices of synthetic rubber went up very high and brought natural rubber prices with them, that's when the federal government and industry has dumped tons of money on let's do domestic rubber. But as soon as normal commercial situations return and the rubber price drops, then they say, oh, no, don't need it. It's gone again. And so it's been this stop, start, stop, start. And so my research has always been focused on how do you get this to go in normal economic times? And then going back to when I first started working on this, as I mentioned, we were looking for enzymes and genes. So in the approaches I was taking, I was already aware that the protein profile of the different rubber-producing species was quite different. And if you raised antibodies against one, you didn't see a lot of cross-reaction with others. Then in 91, type 1 latex allergy became a huge problem in the United States. We had a lot of deaths. Over 10% of the population ended up with this awful type 1 latex allergy. And the death rate for anaphylaxis to this is about 50%. You know, spina bifida kids and paraplegics got up to like 70%. It was a huge, huge problem. And this was caused because of the AIDS epidemic. It's very interesting how things all tie together, but the CDC said everybody has to wear gloves now. And demand went from about 2 billion to 30 billion just like that and per year. And so the a lot of new manufacturers sprang up over the Far East, and they stopped washing the gloves during the process of manufacturing. Now, this left all the soluble proteins in the gloves, because when you tap the latex, you're actually tapping a cytoplasm filled with all sorts of goodies, including tons of proteins and the rubber particles in the emulsion. Now, before, you'd make this glove, and in the middle, you'd wash it, and all those soluble proteins would be removed. Now they were left in, and the patients washed them out. in their bodies. And as powder was still used in those days, it's only recently been eliminated, that in the glove, the powder inside the glove would attract these soluble proteins that would stick to the powder. And then as the nurses put the glove on, a few minutes later, take the glove off, snap, the powder, protein-covered powder would go in the air, and the healthcare workers would spend all day breathing it in, and they would be extracting these proteins with their lung mucosa.
I remember that powder. You described that, and I remember it.
If you had high-protein gloves, you were then breathing in high-protein powder and you'd get these type 1 latex allergies. More than 10% of our healthcare workforce at that time had to retire through disabilities because they could no longer work in the area without being at danger of an anaphylactic reaction. It was a terrible time. Now, that's mostly been fixed, so gloves are leached now, but it just... anyway, it was a huge problem. So I already knew that at least one of these domestic potential crops, Wayuli in this case, which is from the Chihuahuan Desert, so it's a perfect crop for the Southwest, especially with these serious droughts that are preventing a lot of our farmers from even being able to grow cotton and alfalfa anymore, that I proposed at that first international conference, why don't we use Wayuli latex instead of Hevea latex? It's softer, it's stretchier, it's the best film product. You make better films than any other material, and it does not cross-react with type 1 latex allergy. And even if you've got full-blown latex allergy, you can use these materials safely and still be protected from disease. So that then led me to split the project. And we did commercialize it briefly, but that company, I ended up working for them for 6 years. It went very well for the first three. And the company was being built for sale. That didn't actually happen, but we had, and then it had to turn itself into an operating company. Didn't do quite so well. And then I left the OSU, and the company went bankrupt 2 years later because they built a processing plant that didn't actually work. But we took it through the demonstration scale. So it went from pilot to demonstration. And we had about 3,500 acres of Wayuli in Arizona. So it almost made it. And then when I came to OSU, I started trying to do it again, and hence my company, Energene, to do Wayuli latex commercialization and do it properly this time. we're still trying to get the money. It's, it always looks very close. We're still attempting that. But I'd say for a crop in the desert Southwest, it's ideal. Bridgestone is working on that too. They're now, they've got a lot of government money trying to do tire rubber from Wayuli, and they are recruiting farmers out there, and they are making Formula One race car tires. You see, the big issue in the past has been that the tire companies have really, really wanted this. But as soon as they make some beautiful tire, you know, Cooper tire made 100% Wayuli tire, fantastic, over spec in every respect. And then said, well, when are you going to release this? Well, when can I buy the rubber as cheaply as I can get the tropical rubber? Well, tires, Formula One maybe is a sufficiently specialty, but we've always worked very much on trying to enter the market in those really high margin markets. You know, we're hoping to get a FDA approval, 510K, in the spring for the first natural radiation attenuation medical glove, which you can't actually make with Hevea rubber because you can't get enough of the radiation attenuation filler into it without reducing the performance properties below the mechanical properties required for surgical and examination gloves by the FDA. Now, Wayuli, you could do that with Wayuli because the polymer filler interaction is much greater. And so you can get a lot more filler in it, and it's softer and stretchier to start with. And so you've got a lot of room before you hit those thresholds. Hevea has much less room, and so you can't actually meet the attenuation standard and the performance standard in one go, but Wayuli can.
Now, I'm intrigued. As an agronomist, I'm very intrigued about Wayuli. I have not spent much time learning into it. So you mentioned about the, you know, utilizing this crop could supplement or go into regions of cotton or alfalfa. Is it, how's its water usage, how's its production, and how would it fit into a production system that is traditional for alfalfa or cotton?
With Wayuli, you grow it as a perennial. Okay. So you grow it, and then if you have a fall planting, you could get your first harvest in about 18 months. If it's a spring planting, you have to wait 2 years, because the first year it's really establishing its root system. You don't get a really big top, but the next year you get a nice big top. Then we cut that off near the ground, so we take a pollard basically, and then you extract that. The plant will regrow, and then a year later you can go get it again. And the rubber is produced in the ordinary bark parenchyma cells. So you can't tap it. You basically would harvest it, take the leaves off, make yourself a Waiuli milkshake, mm-hmm. and then separate out the latex like cream from milk using technology from the dairy industry. The amount of water it uses is less than half of cotton or alfalfa. So, and remember, it comes from the Chihuahuan Desert. Now, it will grow and survive on like 8 inches a year, but it's not going to grow very big. So you do still want to water it, irrigate it in times of droughts, so that you can actually get a harvest every year. And so the real beauty of it, though, is you can harvest any particular day of the year. A particular field can only be harvested once a year, but the next field can be harvested on a different day, and the next field can be harvested on a different day. So you can harvest every single day of the year.
Yeah, you could stage it nicely across, so you always have a constant supply of fresh.
Exactly. And so the capex for your processing plant mm-hmm. is much less than if it was something like tomatoes, where you open up your factories for 2 months of the year and they're mothballed the rest of the time.
Actually, no concern about storage facilities or massive storage facilities, because your harvest window is 30 days. How long does the standard, or in a production system, what's the longevity of a stand?
Well, we think it will go for 10 years.
Okay.
And then you'd probably have much better lines coming out of the universities or different breeding programs, and you'd want to replace it anyway. And the other beauty of Waiuli, which is one of the two leading contenders for the US, we could talk about the other one in a minute. But the other thing is, you don't need to use any pesticides on this thing. It's only when you're getting your stand established, if you're using direct seeding, that you need to have some herbicide help there. But apart from that, because it's a terpene crop, it's got lots of volatile terpenes come off the leaves. It's got resin vessels that make the wood really unpalatable to termites. They would starve to death rather than eat it, at least some of the species that we've tested. But nothing will, it's not toxic, but I think it's the boiled spinach of the insect world. You know, they just don't like it and would much rather eat something else unless there's nothing else on offer. And the same goes for herbivores. You know, they can eat it. You know, goats and rabbits can eat it, but they don't want to eat it. It's only if they have to, and there's nothing else on offer. So I think it will be an absolutely fantastic crop in the semi-arid Southwest for the bees coming off the almond orchards in California as they start to move east, because it's clean pollen and clean nectar. And these poor things have been pollinating like mad with nicotinamide insecticides all over the place. And so they're pretty sickly as they come off those orchards. And I think migrating through, you know, a few hundred miles of Waiuli would be a wonderful recovery opportunity for the bees.
So I'm sorry to keep us on this track. I'm just so fascinated with this crop, and I promise I'll let you go to your newer work. But how far north in can this crop make it? Because I look at our high plains in Oklahoma, where we're losing the aquifer, but we do have a fairly harsh winter. So it's a short winter, but it can be harsh.
Well, it can be grown from the high plains of Texas, southern high plains, all the way up through the Central Valley of California. Up to certainly Merced, a bit further north. So you've got this big swath. Mm-hmm. And compared with the survey that was done in World War II for the growing regions, I think it's moved a little further north. So I think there are some parts of Oklahoma, Utah, and Nevada that can grow this. It's competing more with housing than crops.
Absolutely.
There was over 123 million acres identified in World War II. And I think there's more because the weather has been moving, you know, with climate change and stuff. Now, with Oklahoma, what it doesn't like is to be buried in snow. So if it can take snow, But it has to melt pretty quick. A couple of days, you're okay. But if you bury it in snow for a month, you're going to be dead. And the same, if you flood it and it stays flooded for a couple of weeks, then you'll get root rot. Because this is a desert species and it's high oxygen requiring, and it doesn't like to be suffocated, you know. So there in Oklahoma, you have to be careful, and it can go below zero. You can go below freezing, but not a lot below freezing. This isn't, you know, minus 26. No,
I don't survive well in minus 26 myself.
We have those sorts of temperatures in Ohio. We have that in a greenhouse here. This is not a crop for Ohio.
So transitioning, because I don't want to take up all your time today. Tell us a little bit more about the current research and the current topics you're really working on right now.
So with Wyuli, we've been working a lot on these premium products. You know, the gloves I mentioned, those go for over $60 a pair with maybe $2 worth of materials in it. So that type of margin means that even at 300 acres would give you 50% market share. But with that type of profit margin, there's plenty of money for that lucky farmer growing that 300, because we need more products, lineman's gloves, and then condoms, and catheter balloons, things like this. So there's more than one farmer who's going to make a fortune. But anyway, up in the northern states, there the crop play is rubber dandelion. And there's two companies out there, Farm Materials and Cultivat, that are working on commercializing this. And then OSU, in collaboration with Oregon State University and University of Nebraska and Scotts Bluff and University of Akron, have been working on getting this into a good crop state. And we have several scientists here working on weed tolerance and genetic tools, molecular breeding. So looking at getting farmers to trial this with mother baby trials, things like that. And so the rubber dandelion is a root crop. It does make it in lytticifers, but of course you can't tap roots, even if it was cost effective to do so. So what you do with that, if you're growing the crop in the field, and we're like eight generations in for breeding for field vigor, you know, so we get nice big roots in the field. It does prefer a lighter soil. If it's heavy clay, you're going to not get really good root development. You know, you want something quite light, but does need some water. And it will overwinter. So you've got a choice. If you plant it in the spring, you can harvest it late fall. We recommend as late as possible, because as the winter starts to say, I'm coming, the roots will grow like mad. And the amount of rubber, which is in some way related to overwintering tolerance, cold tolerance, that will double up. So you'll get a lot of rubber being formed in that late part of the year. So our best yields actually have been from doing transplants, because we've got a fairly short season up here, and that gave us a couple more months on the hoof, as it were. But in our polar vortex winter, which is that 12, 13 or 13, 14, I forget exactly what it was, we didn't go above zero for more than 2 months, and we were down every night at that minus 26. It was horrible, really brutal. But half the crop that overwintered survived and came back in the spring. So we did not lose. It was tolerant of that. Wyuli would have been dead as a doornail, but rubber dandelion made it through. But so you can overwinter if that turns out to be the best way. That's one route, and Farm Materials and Cultivat are working with other companies to get this into the field as a field crop. And Farm Materials is partnered with Goodyear, and both of them have grants from BioMade. But the other thing that we have developed is a repeat harvest indoor farming system. So an ebb and flow hydroponics, which would be very adaptable to aeroponics. And there you could cut the roots off in 5 weeks, grow them back, cut them off in another 5 weeks, grow them back, cut them off in another 5 weeks. And the concentration of rubber in those roots is the same as what you get in the field after whole season. So it's a much more highly productive system. So if Avea fails, if the rubber tree, tropical rubber tree fails, the quickest way to get rubber would be through indoor farming in greenhouses or vertical indoor farms, like a lot of our hydroponic lettuces and herbs are grown that way now. So it's a well-known technology and could be very rapidly scaled up for rubber production, like 100 acres of greenhouse with its own processing plant, you know, to get rubber in a hurry.
If we had to produce all of our rubber needs in situ in country, how much would that take? I mean, how much rubber are we importing and how much production would it have to be ramped up?
We're importing about 1 million tons, and that's just for manufacturing. We're importing, if you count all the other things we import that contain rubber, and there's 50,000 of them that contain rubber, but we import that other countries make them and we import them, that's probably another 4 million tons. So our requirement in the US is around 5 million tons of natural rubber. And it's because so many things can't be made without it. You can't make a tire without natural rubber. There are no 100% synthetic rubber tires. So a car tire, although you can make it 100% natural, most of our car tires are about 50% natural, 50% synthetic for the elastomer component. There's other things in tires, you know, nylon, steel, and things like that. But an airplane tire is 100% natural. Truck tires are over 90, you know, so the higher the tractor tires, 100. So the higher the performance of the tire, the higher the percentage of natural rubber. You can't land a tire, an airplane, on synthetic tires containing any synthetic rubber because they'll blow up on landing. And when I've talked to pilots on the aircraft carriers, they say those tires that the Navy jets land with, those are single-use 100% natural rubber. And they used to chuck them overboard, but they have to take them to home base these days because of polluting the oceans, you know.
So if we scale up and look at just what could 100 acre of a grow facility, a greenhouse facility, like we were talking about, how much rubber could 100 acre facility produce in a single year?
In a multiple harvest system, if you are doing the multiple harvest system, you could get 100,000 tons per year.
Okay.
You could get a ton per acre off that with multiple harvests, up to 7 harvests a year.
For the field growth, the field operation where you're taking the root up, is that similar to a sugar beet harvest? I mean, would you?
Yeah, you can use sugar beet harvester, ginseng harvester, a potato harvester. Yeah. The issue with it's how big are the plants you're able to grow on your particular soil type, because the gaps in the belt, you know, they have to be close enough that as you're harvesting, your plant doesn't just fall right through back on your field. And then the issue is, do you take the tops off first or second?
Okay.
And then depending on how crowded you make it, you can, if you crowd it, the rosettes will start to stand up, which then suggests you may be able to use a carrot harvester if your tops are standing up, you know, so that isn't fully developed. But of course, the big issue with commercial scale dandelion production is weed control, because it does not have a whole bunch of things keeping other weeds from growing. And I don't know what your weeds are like in Oklahoma, but Ohio just has the waves of different species come through during the season. And you have to, in effect, the challenge is how do you kill the dandelions without killing the dandelions?
Yeah, I just imagine as you're saying that all the weeds that would be competitive and near same species in the broadleaf family, that would just be an absolute disaster.
Yes, yes. Broadleaf weed control is the big challenge. Now, we have developed, this was with one of our scientists, our professors who's since retired, but he developed a protocol with 2 pre-emergence and 1 post-emergent herbicide, which have worked really well. And then his work's being continued by Dr. Fresnado here, where they've done many generations now of broadcast seed out into the field, spray it, collect the few survivors. They make tons of seed, of course, and then you scale that seed up, you put it back out again, you spray it with a higher concentration, you do it. So we have naturally selected herbicide resistant plants, as well as, of course, you can do it with genetic engineering. Now, people do tend to panic a little bit about that. You know, what if you make the common dandelion herbicide resistant? No. But there's no gene flow from rubber dandelion into common dandelion. Because common dandelion is actually, in North America, it's what we call a triploid apomictic plant. But it basically means it doesn't cross-fertilize with anything. So each dandelion, if you look at it, if you sowed the seeds of that particular dandelion, all of its children would be identical to that mother. And it doesn't accept the pollen from rubber dandelion, which is a outbreeding diploid. So it doesn't select it. Now, going the other way, there's a little bit of gene transfer, but it's very low.
That's fascinating. I guess one of my last questions before we have some other questions to wrap up. One of the last questions is, when you're working on this kind of work and you find something like the rubber dandelion, what kind of regulations, you look at a crop that it could have great potential or has good potential, is there a lot of regulation? Because it's not going into food, but it is going into the medical industry. So what kind of regulation is there on bringing in a new rubber source, a new natural rubber source?
Well, the only thing that, from the rubber perspective, it has to qualify in terms of the performance of the product you make with it. So we know that we need high molecular weight rubber. So that's the first thing that you look at. Does this species make high molecular weight rubber? And then it's a case of how do you get it out? How do you produce it? And what changes do you need to make with your compound formulations to create the properties that you need? And looking at both the ASTM standards and the FDA regulations for what's required. Of course, Waiuli rubber exceeds all of those standards, and dandelion rubber looks very similar in properties to tropical rubber. So there's no problem meeting that type of regulation. The biggest challenge for dandelion, if we started to introduce the transgenics and the gene-edited plants, is aphids. Is giving them the confidence that, that there really is no gene flow. But there isn't. We've already published several papers on that. So it shouldn't be a huge problem. But this is one of the reasons we did the natural, the spray and pray and weigh approach for increasing herbicide resistance, because aphids doesn't really care about that if you do it that route. They only care about it if you do it the other way. The agroecological implications are exactly the same, whichever you do. So we wanted to do all those gene flow studies anyway, but it's not going to make common dandelion herbicide resistant. And so far, we have no indication that rubber dandelion can become weedy. I wish we had that problem, but it's not vigorous enough. It will grow well with itself, but it's very poor competitor with weeds. So, if you have an escape and it lands somewhere else, your new crop there or your weeds on the verge, they will all outcompete it, and it won't make it.
Is the extraction process fairly energy heavy? How's the extraction compared to the traditional natural rubber?
Well, the traditional way, of course, is you tap the tree for $10 a day, if you're lucky, and collect it in little cups. The amount they collect, by the way, is equivalent to more than 13 full-grown African elephants a minute. So there's a lot of very poorly paid people doing a very semi-skilled job, actually. But nonetheless, that's how it's done. And then you dry a whole bunch of it or coagulate it if you're going to make tires. So about 89% is solidified and turned into solid rubber, and the rest goes for latex. One comment on that, of course, we've needed a lot more. I don't know if you recall, but I said when AIDS came, we used 2 billion, it jumped to 30. Well, before COVID, we were already using 300 billion. So remember, in my lifetime, when I started this, it was 2. Now it's 300. With COVID, it doubled to 600 billion. That's another million tons of latex a year to make to make 2 billion gloves. You need a million tons of latex.
I had a note to ask about, if we had time, to ask about the impact of COVID on latex demands, because I only assumed it probably doubled. So
yeah, and nitrile was able to pick up about a billion gloves, but not the other 2 billion. And of course, nitrile doesn't make nearly as good a glove as the natural latexes do. But even though it's, the exam glove market is heavily dominated by that because of type 1 latex allergy. But you get better disease protection out of a natural latex glove, and it's not dangerous provided it's leached during manufacture.
So the plant extraction, is it a squeezing extraction for the most part?
No, for the dandelion, if you're going for latex, they use the same process. So milkshake, then separate out the cream, like latex that cream from milk, because it's lighter than water. Now, if you're doing solid rubber, in dandelion, a lot of the rubber, the latex, is already coagulated into solid rubber in the plant. So the best methods for that at the moment are take the roots, dry them, and then extract it all as solid rubber. And another of our professors here, Dr. Fred Michel, has developed an enzyme-assisted extraction process for producing rubber, and it's all water-based. The latex extraction is also all water-based. Bridgestone uses a solvent-based system, as I believe Cultivar and Pharmatures, I believe, are using solvent. I know they've looked at the different possibilities. So Bridgestone is basically they'll dry it in the field partially, and then they'll finish drying it at the processing plant, and they'll chip it, solvent extract it, and then purify it and get the rubber that way. But you can go straight from the latex to a deresinated Waiuli rubber if you're going to use, or dandelion rubber. So you can go through the latex route. And I prefer the water-based route myself. But that's, you get only good rubber that way. All, any degraded rubber doesn't come through that process. So you don't have to worry about separating that out later.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, as we wrap up, I have three personal questions, I guess, as they like to set up for this podcast. And so we'll wrap up with these three final questions. The first one they ask is, what is your favorite crop-related book or resource? So what's a resource you've gone back to over the years, or just a favorite book to read?
Well, Mark Finley's got a really good book about the politics behind domestic rubber production between the beginning of the industry and the end of World War II. So that one's a really good one. I'd have to go and have a look for the title. It's got a fairly long title, but it was by Mark Finley. He was working on the next one, but unfortunately he tragically died in a car accident. And so that the next one, and then there's one that's very interesting by Wade Davis called One River, which is the story of his mentor, Schultz, who collected Hevea, was in charge of extensive Hevea collections from the Amazon in the modern era. And the USDA did have a plantation of tolerant, of salve-tolerant trees. But Ezra Benson, when he was the Secretary of Agriculture or in charge of AMS, I think at USDA, why are we paying for this? We don't have Hevea trees in the States. So they destroyed it all, threw it all away. But it's very interesting. But both of those books do have stuff in the beginning about the appalling atrocities that were committed by the European rubber barons in Brazil and related countries. So you need those, and they're awful. You know, I never reread those initial chapters because the abuse was just appalling. You can't imagine how bad it was. So if you don't want to get nightmares about it, don't read the first couple of chapters of either of those books.
So the final question would be, if you were to give any guidance to a graduate student or young scientist, early career scientist who's getting into this field, any, you know, little tidbits of advice for them to make sure that they're successful and can set themselves apart?
Well, one is perseverance. And then work on what interests you the most. You know, if you're not working on something that you find interesting, that's a terrible thing to do to your career. You know, if it's not of interest to you, you're just doing it for the stipend, you know, that's not going to be a satisfying career.
It's a job and not a career.
Yeah. So for rubber biosynthesis or rubber producing crops, this is the long road. But if we can get them established, which I hope to completely finish in my lifetime, then there's an enormous potential. Just imagine, we spread this out. We need 600 processing plants. We need this across the US. We could become a rubber exporting country. Think about all the thousands or tens of thousands of people who've made their careers in corn. You know, those are all to be done in rubber producing domestic crops. And then if you're a plant breeder, you know, you break out the champagne in corn. If you made like 0.5% difference, we could double the yield in a year, you know. So, you know, getting in early at the beginning of what should be a massive new crop, you know, arguably you could say the last one that really made it in the States was soybean. But just imagine becoming one of the people at the beginning of soybean, you know, a beginning of corn, you know, we are still in the baby steps for domestic rubber crops. So it's a very exciting option for production.
Well, Dr. Cornish, thank you so much for your time today. I've been absolutely intrigued. I didn't know what I was going to be getting into with just being this podcast host, and to think that you're my first, I was really like, you're my first interview. So I did not know where to go. And this has just been so, so pleasurable. I've just had so much fun with you. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, good. Thank you. And I really hope, my dream on this, I want to be able to drive down the interstate in any part of the States and either see the golden dandelion fields on either side with the occasional processing plant looming in the distance, or in the southwest, the same for Wayuli, drive past those miles upon miles of Wayuli crops with processing plants scattered amongst them.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.